Hello, and welcome to the Nattercast special edition interview with Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson. Dr. Tyson is the Frederick P. Rose Director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City's American Museum of Natural History, and the host of the upcoming series Cosmos, which will air on March 9th on Fox and the National Geographic Channel. Cosmos was produced by Seth MacFarlane and by Carl Sagan's widow, Anne Druyan, and is based on Sagan's original 1980 series, which aired on PBS. All right, well, how's everything going with your press tour?
Oh, yeah, it's exhausting, but thrilling. Exhilarating.
Exhilarating. Well, it's exhilarating to be able to talk to you. When I got the note, I was like, oh, hell yeah, I want to talk to Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's a huge hit to my day's calendar. Uh-huh. I'm persistently reminded that for most people who are conducting the interviews, and I presume yourself included, it's not the the show is coming out, I got to do an article, and so I got to do it. That there's an enthusiasm and an anticipation that is I find that I'm deeply hopeful about what this means for the future of America and for the world, that science literacy is something that can be embraced and nurtured and that the comfort level that people have with science can change.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when we saw before even this contact, when we saw that you were doing Cosmos, it was like, oh, this is incredible, you know, because we've learned so much since the original Cosmos, and we've had so much innovation in effects and things like that that you can really, carry forward, Dr. Sagan's legacy.
Yeah,
honor.
It's a good point. By the way, it's not only the methods and tools of storytelling are significantly advanced, but it's not only that. Because it's on network, we have some resources in the making of Cosmos that allowed us access to people who previously brought their craft to cinema.
I see.
Rather than television, much less a documentary, right? So our director of photography is Bill Pope, who was the director of photography for the Matrix trilogy. So think about it. When you think of a typical documentary, you think of there's somebody in a lab coat behind a test tube, and there's a camera on a tripod, and they get asked a question and they answer.
Uh-huh.
In that scenario, the camera is visiting the scene,
right?
Okay, and the camera is sort of is you listening to the person. Whereas when Bill Pope gets a hold of a camera, given all the camera angles and camera concepts that he went through to do The Matrix, he also did Spider-Man, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
That now he's bringing those methods and tools to bear on our telling of the story of the universe.
Well, that's great. I'm sorry.
And so now when you see Cosmos, it affects you not only intellectually, as any good documentary should, but it would affect you emotionally and even spiritually. Spiritually, small s, just, where the awe and wonder of looking up. And it's because of all of these resources combined that we have high expectation for the potency of this as a series.
So you've anticipated my first question. The original series aired on PBS, and this is going to be airing on National Geographic Channel and on Fox. And I guess it would be fair to say that the kind of production that you can put on is part of the reason for the change, or were there other reasons?
Oh, well, of course, when we first shopped around the idea, we went to the normal sort of cast of, the normal sort of list of networks. So we went to PBS and Discovery Channel and Science Channel, which is owned by Discovery Channel, and National Geographic as their own entity. And while we were doing this, I had met Seth MacFarlane at a special meeting in California intended to bring together Hollywood storytellers and artists with scientists. And I didn't think much would come of that. You exchange emails, and that's Hollywood, so why would I think anybody would call me back? And they're into their thing, and I'm into my thing. But Seth called me one day and said, I'm in New York. You want to do lunch? And I said, well, sure. And he told me he wanted to do something that served science in America.
Hmm.
And he came to me to ask me what he should do. And at the time, we were shopping around Cosmos. And I thought, well, maybe he'd be able to be an investor in a pilot mm-hmm. that we would put together, and that way we can show that it's good and maybe get sponsors after that. And that way we can make the project we wanted rather than folding it into the traditions of these other networks. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, he said, I have a good idea. Let's take it to Fox. Now, there's a series of thoughts I'm about to share with you that I think lasted about 12 seconds, right?
Okay.
So my first thought was, that is the stupidest idea I've ever heard. He doesn't get it. He doesn't understand. This is a wasted lunch.
Right.
And I said, but wait a minute. Fox is like 20th Century Fox, and Fox Searchlight Pictures, and 20th Century Fox brought Avatar to the screen, and Searchlight brought Slumdog Millionaire, and there's Fox Business, and yes, there's Fox News. We also have Fox Network, which has the acerbic liberal commentary rampant in The Simpsons, and Family Guy is there, and have the number one show on television, and there's Fox Sports. Then I realized Fox has more demographics of American culture going through their portfolio than any other nation, I mean, than in any other network. And so I concluded that there is no better place to put Cosmos than on Fox. So 12 seconds later, I said to him, that's the best idea. That was what was going through my head.
12-second process. A long 12 seconds.
12 seconds.
So, well,
I was fast thinking.
That brings up a question that I've heard you talk extensively about, which is the need for our culture of space exploration to tie into our sort of our more mundane and, you know, persistent economic and political needs, and how space exploration can really advance our political interests, our economic interests, and things like that, and spur innovation and create jobs and that kind of thing. And if you've come to this kind of like private industry where there's been all this innovation over the last 35 years, you know, in information technology and filmmaking and computer graphics and all that kind of thing. And so does this kind of, do you feel this kind of validates your point of view on how space has to be, you know, part of our regular lives and not just some
vision?
Yeah, my
view is slightly, that's a great retelling of it, mm-hmm. but my view is slightly different from that.
Yeah.
It's not that space itself is what will be our savior here.
Mm-hmm.
It's that when you go into space, it stimulates an interest in the STEM fields.
Right.
And it's the stimulated interest in the STEM fields that promotes innovations in science and technology that leads to the 21st century economy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, let's go to space because space does all of this. It's not that it doesn't do it directly. It does it indirectly. And you get to make discoveries along the way. That's mm-hmm. the fun part. So the validation, oh, by the way, from the IT revolution, as significant as it is, has left us unfulfilled with regard to transportation and energy needs and infrastructure needs. There's more to society than information. And I think we've been distracted by the stunning advances that information technology has brought us, to the exclusion of other very deeply held needs that we have in society.
Mm-hmm.
What is our control over natural forces so that we don't have disasters such as tsunamis and hurricanes? And do we run away from them, or do we find a way to tap the energy of a hurricane and have that energy drive the city that the storm would have otherwise leveled?
Mm-hmm.
This is a whole other frontier. That's the kind of frontier that would be addressed if you go into space. Because it involves hardware and people and destinations and going places you've never been before.
Right.
And life support and a knowledge of the solar system and of the sun. And so I see that as a transformative force that could turn a sleepy nation into an innovation nation.
Yeah, very good. So, you know, in being outspoken about this idea that space exploration, you know, can serve these political interests, you've been somewhat critical of those who feel like it's just that we don't have a Kennedy, we don't have lack of leadership. And did I see here that you actually called Buzz Aldrin clueless? I wanted to ask, do you have a death wish? Because he's like the Chuck Norris of space exploration. I've met Buzz. I was lucky to pull if I could pull back a bloody stump.
Calling him clueless. I think I said that he was he was in the front row, and I at one point said that there are factions among us who suffer from Apollo necrophilia. I did say that, but that's I don't remember. I might have said clueless, but I don't remember the context.
Right.
And
I believe it was in the context of feeling like, you know, his point of view on you know, we have to travel space because it's our destiny, or it's in our DNA, or it's some it's motivated by.
Yeah,
something.
I would certainly have arguments against that, but I don't think I would use the word clueless.
Yeah, no, I was going to say I wouldn't either.
Well, plus I'm friends with him, so if I did say something that sounded halfway disrespectful,
no,
because I'm friends with the guy and I can get away with it.
Sure,
but. I just don't remember saying clueless. It was, he lamented that he longed for the days when people remembered every astronaut who was launched. And he worries that maybe there's no enthusiasm today. And I said, this is one of my earlier disagreements with him. I said, it's the fact that we don't know the names of the astronauts that's evidence that going into space has become routine.
Right. Right.
And that's what we were all expecting the future to bring.
Sure.
That space would be routine. That's exactly what that's what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know when the next shuttle launch is. That's because we do it all the time.
Right.
So isn't that a good thing?
Sure.
Yeah. You can invert the argument and make the opposite case, is my point.
Sure. So, well, speaking of like, you know, how times have changed in terms of what we are conscious of in the sciences and what we remember, do you feel that, you know, in the production of this show, you know, for a new generation, do you feel that there's that people still need basic science explained to them the way they did in 1980? Are there things that are people more commonly understand today than we did then? Or did we have more understanding back then and that we've lost?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think, as an educator in modern times, I would answer you differently than I might have answered you 35 years ago. Because I'm just that old. So, I've come to learn now, as a science professional where my day job is at a museum. In a museum, how long does a person stay in a museum? A couple hours? You know, 4 hours at most.
Mm-hmm.
If you were the class, you're probably class of kids, it's probably only a couple of hours. There are people who would want exhibits in a museum to have a whole lesson plan so that if it's successful, you can then poll the people and ask them, what did you learn? All right. And then judge the success of the exhibit based on how well they did on these follow-up exams. I have a different view. The person is going to spend incalculably more time in a classroom than they will ever spend in a museum.
Mm-hmm.
So the role of the museum should not be as a supplement to the school curriculum. It should be as a force to ignite flames within a person's soul of curiosity.
Hmm.
So an exhibit should take a person and say, and have them say, wow, oh my gosh, I got to find out more about this. And all of a sudden, the flame triggers the person to explore more advanced accountings of the topic at hand, or to go buy a book, or take out a book from the library, or see more science videos. And once the flame is lit, then the learning becomes self-motivating.
Hmm.
And so Cosmos, at its best, will do that.
I see.
And not present, you know, Wikipedia pages for you to read.
Right, right. It's not just a dump of information, it's an alignment.
Correct.
Yeah. Speaking of which, it leads wonderfully into my next question, which is, suppose Carl Sagan was able to see your series, you know, and orient himself to our current understanding of science. What do you think that he would learn from your show?
If he was
alive today and able to see your show, and that was the, you know, your Cosmos, and it was his introduction to the last 35 years of science, what would Carl learn?
Well, so here's something I want to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
The goal of this Cosmos is not to update the science. That's not the goal.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of science has happened since 35 years ago. We discovered 1,000 exoplanets, for example. But that's not the goal, because there are documentaries on any station that you channel surf. Not any station, but at any time of day, you can channel surf and land on a documentary about some scientific topic in the universe, on black holes or colliding galaxies, or the search for life, or the Big Bang, or dark matter, or the Higgs boson. There's no end of documentaries that serve that role. Cosmos, however, has as its mission statement the effort to convey to you why science matters.
Mm.
And that is different. That's a different motivating factor from, here's all this new science I want to teach you.
Right.
And once you learn how and why science matters, you take ownership of that point of view. When you take ownership, then you then are self-driven, and you are, it's, you take the responsibility yourself to continue to learn. So it's a new cosmos, not because there's so much more universe to talk about. Mm-hmm. It's a new cosmos because the country and the world need it more than ever to learn, need to know more than ever why science matters.
I see. Well, and speaking of why science matters, another thing that I've heard you say is that astrophysicists are among the most humble people in the world because they confront their ignorance on a daily basis.
Precisely.
And
yeah, that's about right. I mean, if you say what was around before the Big Bang, I have no idea. What's at the center of a black hole? I have no idea. These are not complex questions that require high level training to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're blunt, simple questions. What is dark matter? I have no idea. What is dark energy? We don't know. But here's stuff we do know, and we're proud of that. But we, as research scientists, work hard to put a foot in the unknown and use that as a sort of carrot to keep us searching.
Mm-hmm. I've heard you say that dark matter and dark energy should be renamed Fred and Wilma.
Yeah.
Can you explain that very briefly?
Oh, yeah, because I say dark matter, and you say, oh, what kind of matter is that? Well, we don't know if it's even matter. It's really dark gravity.
Right.
So dark matter is a misleading. People hear, there's so much first impression in a word, and if people are saying, well, what do dark matter and dark energy have in common? Because they sound the same. If I call them Fred and Wilma, you wouldn't be asking, what does Fred and Wilma have in common? You'd be asking the questions separately from one another. But because they both have the word dark in it, people think they're related. And maybe they are, but at the moment there's no indication or evidence that that's at all the case.
Mm.
And so there are two entities that we've measured, but we have no idea what they are, and they got involved in the naming game earlier than I think they should have.
I see. Okay, just one more question. So the main-belt asteroid 13123, which was discovered by Shoemaker and Levy, was named after you, Tyson. So
yes,
how does it feel to be a literal rock star?
Ah, I never thought about it that way. In fact, the very word asteroid means star-like
mm-hmm.
in Latin. Aster is star, and oid is like. In a telescope, there's just a dot of light, just the way stars appear as dots of light in telescopes. And so, of course, there's nothing overlapping with actual stars at all, but people in the early days just described things, labeled things what they look like through a telescope lens. But no, it's a high honor, although, given the number on my asteroid, it should tell you that there's 1,322 other asteroids with names on them. So it's not an especially exclusive club. I have many more achievements that have fewer other people who achieved it than have asteroids named after them. Yet, it's still kind of a cool thing.
Yeah.
To have an asteroid. It's still kind
of
cool.
Well, I want to thank you for talking to me today, Dr. Tyson, and I very much look forward to seeing the rest of your series. It's going to air on March 9th.
And thanks for your enthusiasm and your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right.
You have a good day.